This is Arthur Eggert. This is the third day of October 2003. We begin, this is the fifth chapter of Hosea, beginning tonight. In this chapter, we have another call to hear. God is always calling his people to hear him. But this time, it's the priests and the kings of the ten tribes. They were responsible. The kings and priests are responsible for the God held them responsible. And judgment then is upon them. If they don't judge properly, then God will judge them properly. And many people of God don't realize that the place that God has given ministers, and, well, all of his people for that's concerned, and they're responsible to function in the place as a servant of God where God has put them. No matter how small it might be, even just sitting in a seat in a meeting on time, how wonderful it is to be faithful to where God puts us. If he's called us to a place, that's where he wants us. And so they're going to come up short if they don't fulfill their place. Unfaithfulness always brings judgment in the scripture because your life becomes a snare to so many other people. You'd be surprised how many people look to us. We claim to be a Christian. We claim to be a child of God. They look to us to as an example to the things of God. Jeremiah was called a weeping prophet. And he gives us some information in the fifth chapter of Jeremiah. Turn over and glance at that for just a minute. Chapter 5, verse 26 and 27. It says, "For among my people are found wicked men. They wait, as he seeth, set of snares. They set a trap, they catch men, as a cage is full of birds, so are their houses full of deceit. Therefore, they are become great and waxen rich." So the purpose for the trap and cage is to bring people under their control so that they can become richer. And the world is going that way today. They like to bring the poor people under control so the rich people can get richer. And so this is, we can see prophecy, as far as that's concerned, being fulfilled. And it's true concerning even the church, too. They teach them to, by their actions, taking people into bondage. Only the power of God can set people free, and it can only set them free by a knowledge of the truth. So, verse 1, we read, "Hear ye this, O priest, and hearken ye house of Israel, and give ear, O house of the king. For a judgment is toward you, because ye have been a snare on Pisbah, and a net upon Tabor." Pisbah actually means a watchtower. And Tabor, the meaning of that is, "Thou wilt purge." Now these are two areas where the arch enemy likes to work in people's lives. He likes to tear down their watchtower, make it infallible, and purge them so that they can't be of any value. First, he can bring the watchtower down. Well, bring the watchman off of the watchtower is what I want to say. Bring the watchman off the watchtower, and he can come with full force. And we're to stay put. That's the best thing I can say. Stay put on the watchtower and keep watching. In 2 Samuel, I want to read a verse out of there. A verse of describes what we're saying here. 2 Samuel chapter 22. Verse 50 and 51. "Therefore I will give thanks unto thee, O Lord, among the heathen. I will sing praises unto thy name. He is the tower of salvation for his king shall and showeth mercy to his anointed, unto David and to his seed evermore." So knowing that Christ is our watchtower, our tower of deliverance, he is the only true basis of worship. His love and mercy is upon us as we dwell among the heathen, even today. Let's go back over to Jeremiah again, and another verse that I want to read. In Jeremiah chapter 6, and I'm going to read from verse 26 through 28. "O daughter of my people, gird thee with sackcloth, and wallow thyself in ashes. Make thee mourning, for as for thine only son, most bitter lamentation, for the spoilers shall suddenly come upon them. I have set thee for a tower and a fortress among my people, that thou mayest know and try their ways. They are all grievous, revolters, walking with slanders. There are brass and iron. They are all corrupt. There are several things mentioned here, I think three things mentioned, as a way of escape from the trap, humbling before the Lord and crying to him. The daughters of my people here speak of the weak elements, the weaker sex, usually called the daughters. And so he's speaking to those that are not strong. And here's the thing he won. First, he says, gird thee with sackcloth, wallow in the ashes. Third, make thee mourners mourning, as you were mourning for your only son. Fourth one, bitter lamentations, for the spoiler shall suddenly come upon us. And how true this was, and how true it's going to be again. Said that Tamar, meaning purged, to take away the things that God does not want. Now, if God purges us to take evil things out of our life, or things that he doesn't want in us, even the dead things, this is fine. But when the enemy purges us to take the good things out of our life, then this is not so fine. And this the enemy will try to hinder us in every way and set traps and wrap a net around us to make us helpless so that he can have his way in our life. Another verse that came to mind, talking about purging, another verse came to my mind today was in 1 Corinthians 5:7, where Paul told the Corinthians to purge out therefore the old leaven, that you may be a new lump, as ye are unleavened. For Christ our Passover is sacrificed for us. Purge out the old leaven, we might be a new lump. Another thought, 2 Timothy 2:20-21. And we all know this verse, I think, pretty well. We've heard it so many times. But in a great house there are not only vessels of gold and of silver, but also wood and earth, and some to honor and some to dishonor. If a man therefore purge himself from these, he shall be, 1, a vessel of honor, 2, sanctified for the master's use, and the third one is prepared unto every good work. So three things happen in a purged life when he purges himself, isn't it? And this is what I want to be. Then I can't be hindered from being purged by and be purged by the good things out of my life or the enemy. All right, verse 2, let's go on. And the revolters and profound to make slaughter, through though I have been a rebunker of them all. Israel is called here revolters. The word means to depart from the right or to turn aside from the best. The word profound here means to seek deep, so that, well, I think the thought here is that they were determined to seek deep into error. God is the rebuker. In Psalms 39:11, it says, when thou with rebukers dost correct man for iniquity, thou makest his beauty to consume away like a moth. Surely every man is vanity. Selah. The purpose for a rebuke is to humble and to correct a person. And God is the rebuker. Another verse is in Isaiah 66:15. It says, behold, the Lord will come with fire and with his chariot like a whirlwind, to render his anger with fury and his rebuke with flamers of fire. Flames of fire. I'm going to read one more along this line and drop the thought. But in Ezekiel 25:17, read, and I will execute great vengeance upon them with furious rebukes, and they shall know that I am the Lord when I shall lay my vengeance upon them. So when God rebukes, great power is exhibited, and they will know that they have been rebuked. They'll know that God wasn't pleased with their action. Verse 3, he says, I know Ephraim, and Israel is not hid from me. For now, Ephraim, thou committest whoredom, and Israel is defiled. Ephraim here is distinguished from Israel, also from the other nine tribes. It was the most powerful, Ephraim was the most powerful and warlike tribe of the northern kingdom. They boasted in the fact that they were Ephraimites because the king Jeroboam came from that tribe. And he wasn't a good king, and so when they boasted Ephraimites, they wasn't really boasting on a good fact, were they? Because King Jeroboam wasn't a good king at all. Yeah, but God knows all things. He knows the heart of people, and he knows people's lives. In Isaiah 28:15, read, "Because you have said, we have made a covenant with death and with hell, are we at agreement? When the overflowing scourge shall pass through, it shall come upon us, for we have made lies our refuge, and under falsehood have we hid ourselves." And then in verse 17 of the same chapter, he says, "Judgment also will I lay to the line, and righteousness to plummet, and hail shall sweep away the refuge of lies, and the water shall overflow the hiding place." This is what they said they were, and here's what God says they were. In Isaiah 29, verse 15, that's right close here, God says, "Woe unto them that seek deep to hide their counsel from the Lord, and their works are in the dark. And they say, who seeth us, and who knoweth us?" And they think that they get by with all these things, but they're not getting by with anything, because God is there, and he's going to judge. He's going to lay judgment to them. Just like he says, "I will lay to the line," or measuring line, and that would be horizontal measurement, "and righteous to the plummet," that would be vertical measurement. And so whichever way they look at it, they're going to be measured according to the deeds in their life. In Jeremiah 23, verse 24, we read, "Can any hide himself in a secret place that I shall not see him, saith the Lord? Do not I fill heaven and the earth, saith the Lord?" And how foolish men are to think that God doesn't know all the actions of their life. God does know. If he didn't know, on what basis could he judge man? He couldn't, could he? If he didn't know everything. He knows the very intent of our heart. He knows every word that we say, and everything that we haven't asked forgiveness for, he knows all about them. Or else he couldn't rightfully judge. And that's what we've been reading that in Romans 3 on Thursday night. One more verse in 1 Corinthians 4, verse 5. And this is Paul gives this advice to us. "Therefore judge nothing before the time until the Lord come, who will bring to light the hidden things of darkness and will make manifest the counsel of the heart, and then shall every man have praise of God." So man can't hide from God, and there will come a day when all the things will be exposed, and man will not be able to argue with God, not for a minute. He'll stand at all. He'll have nothing to say to God when judgment comes. In verse 4, we read, "They will not frame their doings to turn unto God, for the spirit of whoredom is in the midst of them, and they have not known the Lord." They were so tied to the way they were going and what they were doing, they were not willing to even consider hanging it up. And that's what frame means. It means to put a frame and hang it on a wall. Well, they didn't want to do their life that way. They didn't want to frame their life because it was full of whoredom. The spirit of whoredom was in their very heart. Would you want to hang that on the wall as a manner of life that you've been? No, we wouldn't want to show the world, would we, what kind of life it was if our heart was full of the spirit of whoredom? But when God should have been, he should be the one hanging there, framed, but instead, the spirit of whoredom. And this is the same spirit that Gomer had in chapter 1, wasn't it? Very same spirit. Just can't seem to cleanse herself whatsoever. Verse 5, "And the pride of Israel doth testify to his face. Therefore shall Israel and Ephraim fall in their iniquity. Judah also shall fall with them." The reason that they would not turn to God was pride, wasn't it? And there's so much in the scriptures, and I looked up several verses here concerning pride and what God thinks of pride, and it's a terrible thing in the eyes of God. Just simply think that we're something when we're nothing. And the opposite of this is thinking that God is everything and he's all we need. And when I think of pride, there were several verses, and I think I'll just look at them and read them here. But one is in Psalms 10, verse 4. And it says, "The wicked through the pride of his countenance will not seek after God." God is not in all their his thoughts. And when you think of that, the old creation is a proud nature of man. And his own thoughts, he is wise. And he doesn't need God. And this was a condition of the rulers of Israel when Jesus was there. 1 Corinthians 2, Paul says, "Where is the wise? Where is I can't quote all of it, but you know what I mean. It's in there, Corinthians. But he says, "The wisdom of the world God has made foolish." Because it just isn't wise. In Romans 1:28. We read that even as they did not like to retain God in their knowledge, God gave them over to a reprobate mind to do those things which were not convenient. They didn't want to keep God in their knowledge. Why didn't they? Because they were smarter than God. They were wiser than God in their own attitude, in their own opinion of themselves. Why would they need God? And there's a lot of people won't go into the house of God today because they think that they don't need God, that they're smarter than God. They won't seek the Lord. And so this is the condition of people today. In Proverbs 11:2, there's another one that touched my heart. "When pride cometh, then cometh shame. But with the lowly is wisdom." Then people become too ashamed to turn to God when they're proud. Shame comes with it. Proverbs 16:18. "Pride goeth before destruction, and a haughty spirit before a fall." And I guess there's not much I can say about that. That pretty well talks about itself, doesn't it? Isaiah 28:3, "The crown of people, the drunkards of Ephraim, shall be trodden under feet." They are so intoxicated in their own ways. There is only one solution: put the pride under God's feet. And this goes along with Hosea chapter 7, which we haven't got to, but verse 10. It says there that the pride of Israel testifieth to his face, and they do not return to the Lord their God to seek him for all this. And I thought this was exciting, the fact that to testify in court against their own self. That's the thought here of testifying to his own face. Because of this, they'll fall. And because of the same thing, Judah will fall with them. Now, this didn't happen, so it must have a future fulfillment, because all of this hasn't been fulfilled yet. "Doth testify to his face." Jeremiah 14:7 was along with this thought, in which Jeremiah said, "O Lord, though our iniquities testify against us, do thou it for thy name's sake, for our backsliding are many, and we have sinned against thee." Also, we see in Isaiah 44:9, another one in Isaiah 59:12, and I'm not going to read all of this, but were the people any different in Jesus' time than what we're reading here? Had they changed any? Well, in Matthew 23, what Jesus said, I should say, about these people, verses 29 through 31, "Judah also shall fall," but there's a lot of verses in there, but that we could read. In verse 6, "They shall go with their flock and with their herds to seek the Lord, but they shall not find him. He hath withdrawn himself from them." Even though they had cattle, many animals, it doesn't say how many here, it just says herds, flocks. Even though they had a lot of animals to sacrifice, this wasn't what God really wanted, was it? I mean, anybody could kill an animal. They wanted him to seek him. And in seeking the Lord, they still wasn't acceptable because of their attitude. Even though they were willing to offer a lot of animals in the process of seeking the Lord, this isn't the kind of seeking that he wanted them to do. Because what is in the midst of them, in their heart, is what God looked upon. So we read here that God withdrew himself from them. Now, God had told them in Deuteronomy chapter 32:20. And he said, I will hide my face from them. Jeshurun, meaning the upright, I will see what their end shall be, for they are a very frothward generation, children in whom is no faith. Their end has not yet been seen when they rejected his son. God gave them their last chance, and then at the stoning of Stephen, he gave them their last chance. And when they stoned Stephen, he began a transition and brought this glorious gospel to the church. They're still in the same way. In the book of Malachi 3, verse 4, and also in Proverbs 1, you can read from 22 through 33, we have the same story, even at the end of the Old Testament. In Acts 13, when God began to use Paul and Barnabas to spread the gospel, we read, then Paul and Barnabas waxed bold and said, it was necessary that the word of God should first have been spoken to you, Israel. This was a necessity. But seeing you have put it from you, and judge yourself unworthy of everlasting life, lo, we turn to the Gentiles. They judged themselves unworthily by rejection, by unbelief, by a stiff neck. They judged themselves to be unworthy of eternal life. And so God gave the gospel to the Gentiles then. In verse 7 of our lesson, they have dealt treacherously against the Lord, for they have begotten strange children. Now shall a month devour them with their portions. Again, their condition is exposed. Anyone can see that death that was the outcome of all this, because they had dealt treacherously with God. They had broken God's covenant, therefore they were against him. Their fruit was like the stranger or the foreigner. The word for month here is the same as we have for new moon in the scriptures. And in chapter 2 of Hosea, last verse, then shall the children, 2:11, I will cause all her months to cease, her feast days, her new moon, and her Sabbath, and all her solemn feasts, and I will destroy her vines and her fig trees, wherefore she said, these are my reward that my lovers have given me, and I will make them a forest, and the beast of the field shall eat them. So she gave all the credit to her lovers, but the word new moon here is the same as we have here for month. It was a special time. It wasn't the fact that it was 30 days, but it was a very short space of time that would elapse, and then punishment would come upon them. The thing they think would help them would destroy them. And I was thinking about this fact that religion, even today, is the opposite of salvation or deliverance. They were very religious, even after they came out, especially after they came out of Babylon. But even before, the religion went into idolatry and all worshiping the heavens and the stars and everything that you could think of, they fell down and worshiped them. Well, religion is plenteous, but not salvation. And even though they will be able to offer sacrifices at the beginning of the tribulation, God's not going to accept those sacrifices. They're just so many dead animals, because he wants a sacrifice of the heart. All right, verses 8 through 14, the rest of this chapter, the subject is in the day of rebuke. And this is the same as we know in Jeremiah 30 as Jacob's troubles. And you can look that up, Jeremiah 30, verses 7 through 9. And it's called a great day. There'll be none like it. Anyway, it's a terrible day. It's the last 3.5 years of the tribulation. And Jesus says, except those days be shortened, there'd be no flesh left on the earth. During this time, the sound of the trumpet. Notice what it says here. I'm just going ahead and read the rest of this chapter from verse 8. Blow the cornet in Gibeah and the trumpet in Ramah. Cry aloud at Beth Haven after thee, O Benjamin. Ephraim shall be desolate in the day of rebuke. Among the tribes of Israel have I made that which shall surely be. The princes of Judah were like them, and like them that removed the bonds. Therefore, I will pour out my wrath upon them like water. Ephraim is oppressed and broken in judgment, because he willingly walked after the commandment. Therefore will I be unto Ephraim as a moth, and to the house of Judah as rottenness. When Ephraim saw his sickness, and Judah saw his wound, then went Ephraim to Assyria, and sent to King Jarib, yet could he not heal you, nor cure you of your wound. For I will be unto Ephraim as a lion, and as a young lion to the house of Judah. I will tear and go away. I will take away, and none shall rescue him. I will go and return to my place until they acknowledge their offense and seek my face. In their affliction, they will seek me early. In these verses, we see that we're facing, we're heading toward the day of rebuke. It's right around the corner. And during this time, the sound of trumpet, this is a war trumpet. This is a trumpet of alarm. There's no one to help them when they blow the trumpet. There's no one to help them. The word cornet could be translated trumpet as well. Notice over in chapter 8, 1, set the trumpet to thy mouth. That's the same word that's used there. And he shall come as an eagle against the house of the Lord, because they have transgressed my covenant. But it's the same thought here. It's an alarm that will be sounded when the enemy comes in like a flood, and there's nothing they can do. No one there to help them. The difference between the cornet and the trumpet is the sound of it, but they both have the cornet is a clear sound, and the trumpet is a kind of a quivering sound. And people know at that time knew what the sound meant. The first is in Gibeah, meaning a hill. Then the second sound is in Ramah, meaning the height, or the seat of idolatry, high places where they would worship idols. The first is in Gibeah, the third sound, trumpet sound, is a cry in Beth Aven, which means a house of vanity. Now, all three places of these were in Benjamin. The sound of their voice is as loud as a trumpet. Benjamin means the son of my right hand, son of the right hand again. So in these locations, they had offered idols, different to different idols. However, they are still the sons of God, and God still loved them regardless. Benjamin is the lesser or the smaller of the two tribes that stayed with the truth of David. And I thought about Paul, too. He was from the tribe of Benjamin, wasn't he? He brought the gospel to the church. So God's judgment on Benjamin was a blessing to Saul, wasn't it? He was come out of that same tribe. In verse 9, have we read there, that Ephraim shall be a desolate in the day of rebuke. The tribes of Israel shall I make known that which surely be. So now Ephraim, and the word Ephraim means double fruitfulness, but it can also mean a double ash heap, however productive they are. And as a leader of the 10 tribes that will be in the center of God's rebuke. And so I think we look at them here as a double ash heap, because they're far from being double fruitful. God is going to rebuke them. And Ephraim represents here all the northern tribes. He says, I make known that which shall surely be. And God had sent many prophets to them to make them known what shall surely be. And they rejected them, they killed them, put them in prison, went their own way. And they wonder why God judged them. In verse 10, read, the princes of Judah was like them that removed the bound. Therefore will I pour out my wrath upon them like water. Judah, as a leader of the two tribes. Ephraim was a leader of the 10 tribes. And as leading the two tribes, they followed the 10 tribes in sin. Her sinful sister, they followed. Therefore, she will be caught in the tribulation also them. The phrase remove the bound or remove the landmark to gain riches, to gain for themselves. And God gives special instructions in Deuteronomy about removing the landmarks. In Deuteronomy 19:14, he says, thou shalt not remove thy neighbor's landmark, which they of old times have set in their inheritance, when thou shalt inherit the land that the Lord thy God giveth thee for a possession. And then drop on down to Deuteronomy 27:17. He said, cursed be he that removeth his neighbor's landmark. And all the people said, amen, we'll not do it. But you know, this was the big failure of Ahab when he wanted to take over the property of Jezreel. But he had the owner killed so he could have his property. And the land belonged to him. It could never go back to its inheritance. So today, even today, they don't know who owns the land. They don't know what tribe would put there. And when they go back in the millennium, they won't go back with the same layout they had in the book of Joshua at all. Well, the land has been sold so many times, even to the heathen. And the nations don't know what landmarks are, and it's the whole land is living in unbelief. In verse 11, we read that Ephraim is oppressed and broken in judgment because he willingly walked after the commandment. Now, God has a reason for everything he does. And judgment comes because they followed man's commandment. These commandments that they followed were not God's commandment. It was man's commandment. Well, we know the story of Jeroboam and when he separated from Rehoboam. And he set up all new commandments. And these commandments caused them to worship golden calves in Dan and in Bethel. And they still go by the commandments of men. In 1 Kings 14, verse 16, and he shall give Israel up because of the sins of Jeroboam, who did sin, and who made Israel to sin. And all the sins of the kings of Israel were always compared with the first king Jeroboam. We read this phrase, who made Israel to sin, 9 times in the books of Kings. Over and over. When a king sinned, he sinned comparing himself with Jeroboam, the son of Nebat. So, they followed man's commandments. In verse 12, we read, therefore will I be unto Ephraim as a moth, and the house of Judah as rottenness. The moth will eat the covering of the two tribes. Termites eat the house of Judah. Moths eat clothing. Termites eat wood and cause it to rot. The covering is more easily destroyed, and so the 10 tribes were more easily destroyed than the 2 tribes because they were farther away from God. Both the moth and the worms that cause wood to rot slowly eat to nothing. God slowly judged Israel over a period of several hundred years. He didn't do it overnight. He gave them opportunities after opportunities to turn to him. And if you read the history in Kings and Chronicles, the 10 tribes had not even one godly king or priest in all that history. Also, none of the kings were of the line of David in Israel. Judah is the only one that had a line of David for David's sake. Therefore, we read that Ephraim was like a tent, or a light temporary covering. Judah is a house that's more stable, more firm. So the eating took longer, didn't it? The rottenness took longer than the other. All right, verse 13. When Ephraim saw his sickness and Judah saw his wound, then went Ephraim unto Assyria and said to King Jarb, yet he could not heal you nor cure you of your wound. This shows a condition of all the 12 tribes as far as that's concerned. They even, when they saw their need, realized that they were sick. They didn't see help from God, did they? They sought help from the nations. Why didn't they turn to the Lord? Why would they turn to the nations for help? Well, we look at them today. Why don't they turn to the Lord today? Why do they turn to the nations for help today? They haven't changed any, and they'll get no help from God as long as our trust in the nations. Trust Assyria, he wouldn't help them, he was their enemy. The word Jerub here actually means let him contend, or an adversary. Now, this was a symbolic name for Assyria. There was never a king by that name, but it was symbolic for the nation. It was used only in Hosea here. Not used, the word not used anywhere else. So it must have been Hosea's pet name for him. But looking at these names, one could see why the flesh would trust in her, because everyone wants to look up to those that are successful and winners in life, but they can't heal. They can't help. Oh, if they would just look to God, if they just seek Him and compare Him to any nation, which would be the best, just which one's the best? Trust in the Lord. Verse 14, and I will be unto Ephraim as a lion and a young lion in the house of Judah. Even I will tear away. And as we read this, God's view of the tribulation in verse 14, God will use the nations to tear Israel to pieces, as an experienced lion would tear to pieces. And Judah as a young lion, and this I think we think of the fast and energetic actions of the nations. But it will be as though they cannot be stopped. But it's God's work, and He's allowing it to happen. And He's going to use these nations to bring Israel where He wants them. The very ones Israel trusts in for help will be the ones that will bring them into despair. In Psalms 50, verse 22, God says to the wicked, He said, Now consider this, ye that forget God, lest I tear you in pieces, and there be none to deliver. And notice in our verse 14, He says, I will tear. Though I think through this, He uses man to do the tearing, but it's going to be the power of God, and He wants people to know it. I will do it. I'll tear, and there'll be none, and I will take away, and none shall rescue. And God's going to do it all. None's going to be able to rescue them. He'll just bring them deeper into destruction. Verse 15, and I will go and return to my place until they acknowledge their offense and seek my face. And in their affliction, they will seek me early. And this will be their blessing when they start to seek God early. But God's going to go far away from them, especially in the first the whole tribulation period. God's going to be far away. Well, He has been ever since they crucified Christ. In fact, ever since the destruction of Jerusalem in 70 A.D. But He's going to leave them completely alone. How long will He abandon them, we ask, until they see that there is no help from the Gentiles? And when they admit their sins and seek the Lord with a full heart, then He will come to their help, and He'll fight their battle for them. When they say that they're ready to turn their need over to Him and cry to the Almighty God to seek Him for help. Well, that brings us down to the end, and we'll stop there.